Good afternoon, everybody. Joe Boma here with another Grit City story. I'm back with Mr. John Bufflin Haley, and this time we're going to be discussing the Bufflin lumber and manufacturing industry that helped build Tacoma. How are you doing today, Mr. Haley?
Just great. Beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to have you back. Thank you for being my most prolific guest.
So far.
So, can you tell me a little bit about, you know, like we've mentioned, the lumber industry that not only is Tacoma famous for, but your family effectively made famous in Tacoma?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're going to have to go back into the history on this. The way it was established, it was, of course, when we talk about Bufflin Lumber. Of course, there were lots of other lumber companies around here, but this is Bufflin Lumber. And it starts with my grandfather, John Bufflin. And to know about him is to know how he got things started. He was born in Holland, a little farming town in Holland.
Okay.
Very poor people. They were farmers, very poor. There were nine children in the family, so you can imagine what that was like.
Yeah.
And grandfather did not like farming. It just wasn't what he liked to do.
I can imagine it wasn't his favorite activity back in the late 1800s.
No, it wasn't. Yeah, that was in 1864.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, right during the civil discourse we were having then.
Just that little spring up, that little flare up that we had.
Yeah. A lot of people died there. Anyway, he was always impressed with what his father had told him. His father had mentioned how work was the answer. I think I have it quoted. He said he was quoted as saying, this was my grandfather's quote, saying through his struggles, they were taught to keep in mind that better times were coming as long as they worked. Work was the only means of realizing hope.
Wow.
That's pretty prolific.
Yeah.
So he, from a very early age, as you're going to find out, he was quite a worker. He started working at age 7 1/2 in the fields.
Oh, wow.
By the time, well, of course, with nine kids,
yeah,
7 1/2, you're getting old.
Yeah, true. So at that point, you got to take care of the other two kids while you're working in the fields.
other eight kids. Okay, by the time he was 10, his health was not working very well for him. He was having trouble working in the fields. And so he had to talk his mother into allowing him to go into town to work for a carpenter.
Okay.
And so he got to learn the wood industry. He didn't have to bend over and dig in the weeds and all this kind of stuff.
So one usually doesn't think of carpentry as light work after farm work at age 7. It might be.
Working in sawdust, not as bad as working in mud.
Yeah, true.
It was a village carpenter, and he quit his formal education. This was about fourth grade. So that was it. He quit. And as he said, working for the carpenter in there, he considered that his first step in a wave of success.
Yep.
Now, that may sound a little arrogant, but
especially coming from a 10-year-old at that point.
Yeah. After 2 years of working at the carpenter shop, he moved to Delft, Holland, where they make all the beautiful tile. And then he became involved in, now this would have been about 10 years old or so, he got involved in socialist efforts.
Okay.
Now, he didn't describe what the social efforts were like, just they were social, socialist party.
Okay.
And so he started working at the printing where they printed the pamphlets, and he would peddle the pamphlets in the street and stuff. And then he had a change in his life. A philanthropic gentleman extracted him from doing this and pointed out that this was not a good thing to be doing. And got him away from this idea. Okay. And so that turned him into looking more at other things to do in the world. And at that time, there was a little canal that the French were trying to build down around Panama.
Oh, yeah, that little thing.
Yeah. And he thought, well, this has got to be a good place to go to work.
Oh, yeah.
That was perhaps not a good decision.
No.
But because there were a lot of people died,
especially
the French.
I say just a few dozen diseases that were wiping out entire workers.
Thousands of people,
unfortunately.
So he was lucky because he was only about 14, 15 at this time. And he had to leave Rotterdam on a ship. And so he got papers and everything, but he had to sneak aboard the ship and hide.
Huh.
And because he couldn't afford the transport.
Ah, okay.
You know, and he wanted to sign the contracts to work at the Panama. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, they said, you can't do it. You're too young. You got to go home to mommy and daddy. So he went home, but the idea was still there.
Say at this time, the ripe old age of 14 and a half, yeah, he was trying to set out again.
He thought, well, maybe I could do this again. Now I'm a much older, wiser person.
Yes.
And so he tried it again. And this time he got a job working on a ship.
Oh, and
then they found out how old he was. He was working, and they would sleep in the coal bins.
Oh, wow.
He and some of the others that he made friends with, they slept in the coal bins. Ooh. And they finally found him and said, no, you're going to have to go back. And so he went back. They went back, and as far as I can tell, they went back to France because the contracts were with the French government, and they went back to France. So what a tough place to have to go back to when you're 15, 16 years
old. Exactly.
So then the story really turns good. Because he started working under a construction company and working at constructing buildings.
Okay.
And it was under, as he quoted, he worked under the great Eiffel.
Good on him.
Yeah, the builder of the Eiffel Tower in Paris. As he said, it was under his direction that he learned the secrets of building, wood, concrete, metal, structures.
That's awesome.
And so he was learning, designing and constructing stuff from Eiffel himself.
So he was just about the only architect that every person on Earth can name.
Oh, yeah.
Tough teacher to have.
Oh, I know. And so then he ventured off into also designing church spires.
Mm-hmm.
And they built a lot of churches in those days, of course, and a lot of spires.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was really the stroke that changed things for him. Now he's basically got an education out of that.
Yeah.
And let's see, by now it was 1893.
Okay.
We're getting close to the turn of the century.
Yeah.
And he was reading articles about Chicago and the Chicago World's Fair.
Mm-hmm.
Was going on then, or they were starting the World's Fair.
Yeah.
And once again, he got thinking, you know, this might be a good place to go to get a good job. And, oh yeah, I didn't tell you about this one. In the meantime, after working for Eiffel and learning this stuff, he ended up going to a company to learn out how they were fabricating metal.
Okay.
They were able to press metal in such a way that it would design. They could use it for church spires and stuff like this.
Okay.
This company, I don't remember the name of it, but anyway, this was back in Germany, I think it was, and he wanted to see how they did it. And so he worked there for a while, and then he snuck into the area that was top secret on how they were doing it. And what it was, he wasn't interested in how they were bending it.
Yeah.
And he knew they were smashing the steel.
Yep.
But what he was wondering is, how could the anvil survive the smashing of the steel?
See, very scientific approach is what he's wondering about. That's awesome.
You know, being now a structural designer.
Exactly,
Okay, they're smashing the steel, bending it. What happens to the anvil?
Yeah.
And so he snuck into where they were doing this and found out that the anvil was placed in a big water reservoir.
Oh, that's cool.
And they could smash the metal and not destroy the anvil.
Huh.
But unfortunately, like the ships going to Panama, he got caught. And so he was banned from, No, maybe this wasn't France. It was either France or Germany. He was banned from any more architectural work in there. And that's what brought his interest into coming to the United States. So now he's reading these stories on how the streets of Chicago are lined with gold. Because there's so much industry and everything.
I mean, he seems like such a self-starter and so industrious, but he's definitely not the sneakiest individual. He's been caught a few times.
And it's a work ethic, too.
Yeah, you know, just keeps trying, try again.
Oh, yeah. Well, like the airplane thing
through.
Oh, God. So anyway, he goes to Chicago, and this time he did it legitimately. Paid for his... My daughter actually found a document on his ship when he left Rotterdam and came to Chicago.
Huh.
Well, not Chicago, New York, wherever it was. Well, he gets to Chicago, and the streets were not lined with gold, not by a long shot.
Jobs were lined with some other things back in the day.
Yeah, much like today. And so he was very disappointed. He said it was crowded and it was dirty. And so he ended up going to Wisconsin and working in the wood factories there.
Okay.
So now he's back in working with wood, carpenter, engineer. And he apparently was very successful there.
That's good.
He was so successful in the plant that at one point they tried to hire him on as general manager.
And, nice promotion. Nice promotion.
Yeah, yeah, and it was a sizable pay increase.
Yeah.
And as I learned, he was married at the time. It turns out he was married at the time. And he turned down the job because he had been studying about the Pacific Northwest.
Okay.
And he, by this time, had gotten several U.S. patents on equipment that he designed for lumber industry.
Nice.
So now he had these patents that people had to pay him to use this stuff. And so it was more reasonable for him to look at another move.
Yeah.
So he moved to Tacoma. And so
starting to bloom at that point.
Pardon me?
Said the city was starting to bloom at that
point.
Beginning.
That would have been, let's see, I think it was 1901 he moved to Tacoma. Yeah.
Yeah, like right at the start of the city, basically.
And, you know, the interesting thing was that was a fascinating time for a lot of people, a lot of industries.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of people similar to my grandfather, immigrants with ideas, with experiences, skills that a lot of people didn't have that were here. And so he got to Tacoma, and now he has some money. Oh, and apparently his first wife died at that time.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. Well, he had a daughter, and he brought her with him.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, at that, he gets to the Pacific Northwest, and he's got some money, and he starts laying ideas for plants, like he worked in Wisconsin.
Okay.
He started looking at the tide flats and how excellent they were for potentially building industry.
Yep.
And as a side note to that is, at one point on the Hyblos River.
Yep.
That's where he bought some property there, got a hold of some property there.
Okay.
He built the plant out over the water on the Hyblos, and everybody thought, why are you doing this? You know, the expensive building this. I mean, they can just haul the logs up and put them on the shore here and everything, and everything's a lot cheaper that way.
Yep.
And he, no, I'm going to do it my way. And it's ironic. It worked out very successful because he could bring the logs in underneath the plant and bring them up and go to work on them.
Found a new system to beat the other guys.
And guess where he's from?
Holland still?
Holland.
Yep.
And what are the Dutch people known for?
Yep, all the dams and waterworks and dikes
the
and all
tide
that.
Tide flats, exactly.
Yep.
So he took some of the things that he learned from there and applied them to this. And, of course, also his wood experience. So 1901, and he established it at that time. He bought a thing, and it was called the Washington Manufacturing Company.
Okay.
And he bought it from somebody, and then he started manufacturing porch columns.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah.
Have you ever seen History of the World Part 1 by chance? An old Mel Brooks movie?
Oh, yeah, I have.
Just remember the Roman market. Columns, columns, get your columns.
And I wonder if some of those might have been Buffalo.
No.
That goes back too far. Anyway, it was a good success for him. And he also had a company going called the American Pipe Company.
Mm-hmm.
And they built pipe out of wood.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was the big material back in the day.
Yep. And as I understand, there is still some of it being used on the tide flats.
Oh, wow. That is built to last.
Yeah. So now he's got some success there. And then in 1913, he started the Buffalo Lumber and Manufacturing.
Okay.
Because he wanted to go into more business. And here we start out with the doors and then the plywood, manufacturing plywood. He needed a much bigger plant for this. So he got that and started producing doors and lumber, plywood. And business became very successful. This was now bought probably in the 20s. And it's so successful, he bought a lumber mill that was right next to him. And he was able to clean up the whole area and add to the factories and add more veneer making equipment and expand the
awesome
lumber.
Yeah.
So it was growing great. Hmm. 1916, was when he purchased that other plant.
Okay.
And then they needed new equipment to facilitate the production of veneers. Now, plywood was great,
mm-hmm.
very popular.
Yeah.
But Bufflin wanted to build a veneer for the top of the plywood mm-hmm. to make it more beautiful.
Yes, a little fancier.
For building and constructions. And so then that new plant was used for the veneer and the gluing, applying the veneer. And sales just went very well. So this was now the 20s. At the same time, Bufflin himself was working on other projects, the American wood pipe. He started a furniture company.
Just casually, on top of all his other businesses.
Yeah. And I'll mention a little bit more about that in a bit here. So he was very involved all over the place. And one thing I noted in some of the writing in here about grandfather was, like, some people came by to interview him about his businesses and stuff like this.
Yeah.
And they were always so impressed. His office was smaller than the living room that we're sitting in now.
Yeah.
He was never over-impressed with himself.
It's good to have a humble company leader, unlike, you know, some of them nowadays.
And he worked with it quite a bit. Yeah. Then timber became unpredictable, acquiring the timber to bring in. So then he started out a timber business. And he had timber plants, I understand, some in Canada, BC, Washington, and Oregon.
So he controlled the entire supply line from basically tree growth to final furniture product
for,
at this point.
For him.
That's awesome.
Of course, other companies, St. Paul was doing the same thing, and he knew these people. They were all pretty friendly with each other. They were there was so much business that they didn't really, as far as I know, worry about their competitors.
Especially
they just kept
at that time of expansion. Yeah, there's
plenty
of room for everybody, actually.
Yeah, plenty of trees. And I've sat back and wondered, you know, he had railroad trains. Mm-hmm. He had a railroad train, and this was in Washington State somewhere. And he actually had the engine and the stuff, and then he would lease tracks and then build tracks so that when they'd go in there, they could haul the lumber out or the timber out. I thought that was pretty interesting, but did they replant anything? I have no idea. Like
probably not back in the day, unfortunately.
I wish they did.
Yeah, well.
So, you know, timber, they would pay for it and make good money off it. Personally, I think they probably did do a lot of stripping of the land, but they had to get the timber in there.
Yeah.
Innovations in the company. Well, yeah, grandfather really started hiring on a lot of management people because he had all these things going on.
Yeah.
And there were such demands that he knew he couldn't be in control of it, that he had to get new management people in to take portions of it.
Yeah.
Bufflin Lumber became the first company in the United States to utilize Philippine mahogany as a veneer.
Fancy.
Very
fancy.
So he imported a lot of Philippine mahogany.
Yeah.
Then the company developed methods to seal plastic products as an overlay on the plywood.
Oh, wow.
Now, I don't know much about that, if they even do that anymore.
I don't think nowadays, but that was big through the 20th century.
Yeah, and it was big. They spent a lot of money on it, a lot of research.
Yeah.
And during the war effort, Second World War.
Yeah.
Okay, they had been through the First World War, made it okay. Now we've gone through the Second World War, Depression.
Yeah.
Bufflin Lumber and Manufacturing still made it through there. They had some tough times, but it didn't bring them down, and certainly not. And now we got the Second World War going.
Yeah.
And I understand that plastic veneer wood they were using on naval ships.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I remember hearing that.
Trying to save some weight and, you know, make certain rooms look nice.
In the long run, a lot of these products were shipped all around the world, well, not all around the world, to Europe, Australia, of course, the Philippines.
Yeah.
And so they were doing really quite well. As a matter of fact, my sister, who was just up here, told me about one of our cousins, nephew of Grandfather Bufflin, was talking about how he was in London, and he was staying at some people's house. And he got curious because he was looking at this one door, and he said, that door looks familiar to me. And he looked at the manufacturer's plate on it.
Yep.
There it was, Bufflin Lumber and Manufacturing Company, all the way in London.
Worldwide. Yeah. Worldwide name.
Oh, yeah. And then I had some great experiences. I was in the Navy. I got out of the Navy, and I went to work for the Department of the Army.
Yep.
Civilian working for the Department of the Army. Sharp's Army Depot, Lathrop, California. So I'm in there to visit the boss. They've hired me as an inventory specialist. Go in to meet the boss. And the boss is interviewing me. He's sitting at his desk, and he's got this folder out there. And he says, your middle name is Bufflin. Do you have any relatives up in the Pacific Northwest? And I said, well, yeah.
Just a couple.
Yeah. That's where I'm from. Well, do you know of John Bufflin? And I said, you mean Bufflin Lumber? And he said, yeah. I said, that was my grandfather. He said, oh, I got my first job at Bufflin Lumber.
Hey, not bad when the new CEO likes you right off
the bat. Oh, I know. Yeah, so we got along real well. So that was a coincidence for me. And then that I've run into a lot of people that have worked for Bufflin.
Yeah, I believe in an industry that large. Yeah, I believe.
Yeah. But down in California, Stockton, California, who would have thought? Let's see. In the 1940s, Bufflin Lumber employed 600 people. And the timber industry that he had, you know, that brought the timber out and all that, employed another 300. Now, that doesn't even mention about, the furniture company was that he formed and was part of. And that was 1921.
Okay.
And it was called Bufflin, Hubert, and Lumen Incorporated. And they manufactured high-class furniture.
Makes sense.
I saw some of this furniture. Well, we had it in that house in Tacoma.
Yep.
And it was gorgeous stuff. It was definitely not Lazy Boy. I like Lazy Boy, but it was not Lazy Boy.
Not the modern press board, actual hand-carved, nice stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Pieces of art.
I lived with my uncle in the university district, and he had a sofa that was Bufflin, and I wish I had gotten the thing, but it was almost ugly. It was so beautiful. It really was. It was red velvet, and it had these brass...
Had like the fabric buttons.
Yeah, but they were big.
The bolts, yeah.
About the size of a quarter.
Oh, wow.
Going entirely around the entire frame of the thing. It was beautiful.
Yeah.
And it was actually quite comfortable.
Hey, that's all you can ask for in fancy furniture.
And I understood that the furniture company became Lynch Furniture.
Okay.
And I don't know if they're still around.
Yeah, so I couldn't tell you that.
Yeah.
It's more research next time.
And then in 1923.
Yep.
Big surprise here again. He started on another business.
Mm.
It was called Tacoma Brickyard.
It sounds like he needed bricks for something, so he just decided, I'll start a company instead of buying them. Yeah.
Well, I think he did a lot of that.
Yeah.
You know, it employed 50 people. Excuse me. Let's see. And then I found that by the mid-30s, Bufflin was starting to divest himself from the company. He was able to devote more energy to his philanthropic endeavors. And as you know, the city of Tacoma.
Exactly.
And he had a whole lot of other ones too, helping out the schools and the churches.
That's
awesome.
He was
very involved with, the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
He designed the spires for, I think it's St. Joseph's right near the freeway.
Mm-hmm.
So he did a lot of things. Retirement to him was not having to work.
I mean, it started, you know, when he was a teenager trying to help workers and moved on to helping kids and families and sounds like everyone around him.
Yeah.
So not a bad retirement goal.
Everything he touched seemed to work out pretty good. Luckily for Mr. Bufflin, now the company we're talking in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
He was able to select excellent people to manage and assume leadership in the Bufflin Lumber Manufacturing. Key players in the management positions, in particular, Phil Simpson.
Okay.
Now, I know that name. I think I've even met the man. He quit Bufflin. Mm-hmm. He served on numerous boards for Bufflin Lumber, but I think he finally divested himself in 1965.
Oh, wow.
Now, see, for me, that's not long ago. I can barely remember the 60s. But anyway, Phil Simpson, and then another one that was key was Henry Mertz.
Okay.
And I like that name, Mertz. It was on a TV show. Henry Mertz, Mike Fetchko, and Arthur Peterson.
Mm-hmm.
And so they assumed control of the company and did very well.
Glad it worked.
A lot of modernization. Technical things were just coming right and left.
Oh, yeah.
And they were keeping up with it.
I was saying, in the 50s and 60s, that was, start of the computer evolution.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's where I should have invested my money. Okay, in 1955, this is interesting. Plans were immediately made by some of the employees to form a co-op.
That's cool.
Yeah, it turned out to be cool.
Yeah.
The Buffalo Manufacturing Company's Tacoma plant. The raw material and inventory were purchased, and the employees owned it. They bought shares, I think, at the time. The share was $4,000.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So anyway, now the employees are part of the ownership of the plant. And I remember my mother saying that grandfather really liked that idea all along. Unions were a big thing in those early years.
Definitely.
And my grandfather was never against the union.
Yeah.
But he prided himself on paying the employees good wages and some benefits.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so the plant never really got unionized. Mm-hmm. So he was very conscious of all this stuff. Mm-hmm. So today, now we're talking over 100 years later.
Yeah.
1913 to 2013. It's still a very prosperous, important part of the Tacoma industry.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That is.
So that's about it from Buffalo Lumber.
That is an incredible story. Do you have any pieces of furniture or, little wood chips still? Or?
I have nothing. Huh. Well, when my Uncle Joe passed, I was really hoping to try to get that sofa. Even though as big and perhaps ugly as it was, I don't have any of it. We've got the piano upstairs that my mother bought.
Oh, wow.
That was in the house, and that picture of the house.
Yep. I'm sure if we dig around Tacoma's buildings, you can find some doors, frames, columns, or any antique store probably has couches and chairs from.
Apparently, he provided all the doors for Bellarmine.
Oh, okay.
At that time, whenever that was. Yeah, he did a lot of that. Then he was, the president of the Tacoma Hotel.
Yep.
And so he must have had a lot of to do with the structure there, even though it burned down.
Yeah.
I think one thing that I've picked out of some of this is I wish I had known more about some of the history of Grandfather Buffalo and of the lumber industry down there.
Yeah.
He was a fascinating man. He did so much for so many, and I wish I had known more about it. There's still things I want to discover about it, like that first wife. He had a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, he bought her a place over on American Lake.
Okay.
And she lived on American Lake. Huh. And I've even got copies of it. When she passed away, her son sent my Aunt Kathleen a letter with photographs of my mother's wedding and college graduation,
awesome.
Stuff like this.
Bringing the family back together.
Well, nobody ever knew her.
Huh. Interesting.
It was all, for some reason, kind of kept hush-hush. Maybe it was that Catholic experience.
Yeah.
Whatever. We were told not to go to American Lake area. The daughter apparently kept track of what was happening to my mother, who was actually... Huh. Her sister, half sister.
Yeah.
And I would still, to this day, like to find her son or grandson.
Yeah.
Any of her children. I hope they live here. Apparently, grandfather, for her wedding, gave her a portion of Clover Park.
Oh, wow.
Her husband was involved in aviation. They got married, so he gave them something in Clover Park Airfield or the college.
Yeah. That's an incredible wedding gift.
Yeah. Kept involved in everything.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's about it.
I truly don't have the words to describe just how integral the Buffalo family was to not only taking care of the people of Tacoma, but helping the city expand. And it seems every way you turned, your family was founding and running another successful industry.
Yep.
So you're very humble about it, but truly thank you and your family for all they've done for everyone around, you know, this city, making it what it is today.
Thank you, Joe. And I'm looking, I'm hoping that people will listen to this and learn more about the history of Tacoma, how exciting it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's hoping that we at the Tacoma Historical Society can help track down some more of these Bufflin family mysteries for you. That'd be a pretty awesome show.
Well, we've got some plans. We've got some plans for some more.
That we do.
Okay.
All right. That was Mr. John Bufflin Haley. And as always, I'm Joe Boma with A Grit City Story. Have a great rest of your day.